Welcome to the Archive Room podcast.
The Nation Station, Manx Radio.
Fastamai, Judith Lay here, welcoming you to the Archive Room, Manx Radio's treasure chest of stories of island life through the years, told by the people who were there. So get those leathers and your helmet on, and let's take a ride back through the years to take a nostalgic look at the TT races and everything to do with them in years gone by. There are some things that have never changed, and it's the need for dedicated and knowledgeable marshals, many of whom had a regular spot on the course where they could be found every year. That was certainly the case for Crosby resident Johnny Gelling, talking here with David Collister.
Well, over 45 years, I worked it out the other night, I have actually spent 300 days standing outside the Highlander pub marshalling for the races. You notice I say standing outside. We were used to many crowds, very big, very large crowds. Of course, originally there was a humpback bridge and the bikes flew through the air. That was a great attraction. But 600-700 spectators was quite normal. And of course, the sector marshal was the legendary Henry Kissick, a man who was a bit slap-happy about his own business, but a giant when he came to the races. He took it very seriously indeed. He insisted that those who marshalled at the Highlander were here at least an hour before the race started in order to get the cars parked and people put down in the right places. And, of course, nobody crosses the road here during the racing. He insisted that he would not allow anybody to drink. You could always have a drink after the race, but he was teetotal and he insisted that marshals behaved themselves in a manner befitting to an auxiliary constable, of course.
And his memory is perpetuated here by a shelter.
It was donated in his memory by the many people he had. There was no trouble at all to raise subscription list. He really was an amazing man. He used to harangue the people. There was no Manx radio in those days, of course. And I'd be sent to the telephone to get the time off the clock. That was the big clock opposite the control at the... It wasn't the official time, of course, but that didn't matter. And to get the weather report. Well, often there was no weather report, so we would make it up ourselves. And he would say, ladies and gentlemen, you are very privileged to be here at this very important vantage spot. The official time is 10:45 and 30 seconds. And the weather report is the mountain is clear, the weather report is good, there's a 15-knot breeze from the southwest, and there's a possibility of rain for the afternoon. There was always a possibility of rain. He would say, you will witness here today speeds in excess of 140 miles an hour. Of course, he was always about 20 miles an hour over the top, but that didn't matter. But he built it up, and he would say, now, you're not allowed to cross the road. If you wish to attend to the bodily functions, you have the choice of two bushes down in the field. And he would say things like, don't let your papers blow on the course, because one of my lads would have to go and pick them up. No, not me, madam. I am in charge. But we will be round at the end of the day. We will give you all the information we can, and we'll be round at the day with the box making a collection, not only for the St. John's Ambulance, but the blind, and we don't mind taking paper money.
He's a great character then.
Oh, yeah.
What about fun and games? Any humorous incidents here?
Oh, I could tell you stories about Warner Ratliff that would close the station, but one particular morning at Crosby, we were talking about safety precautions, and one of the marshals who had said he'd been out having a drink with somebody who worked for the contractor and had mentioned that there were 8,000 bales around the course. And we all agree that they were very essential and that sort of thing. A lot of so-and-so nonsense, says Warner. I don't know why they spend all this money putting up all these bales. If they strapped one to the front of each bike, it wouldn't matter where the hell he hit. So that was Warner Ratliff.
Well, of all the riders then that you've seen pass through here, did they all pass through safely?
Well, we didn't have a great many accidents. Sandy's Winch was killed here in, I think, 1957. I'm not very good on dates, but by and large, we've been very fortunate. Of course, up the road at Pear Tree, there were many accidents. We averaged two accidents a year over a period of about 20 years. And Norman Pallister, who is a relation of Henry's, of course, has been marshalling there for. He has a crew of the most experienced marshals there, and they probably handled more accidents than anybody.
What's your most outstanding memory of this area, then? Is the one?
Yes, I think so. It's a rather sad one, really, because we had a marshal. He was an ex-rider, and he was a sales manager of Victor Horseman in Liverpool, a big motorcycle manufacturer and sales dealer. And he came here for many years. Unfortunately, he died of a cancer, and he asked that his ashes should be sprinkled on the road as the maroon went off. You'll remember that they don't do it now, but they used to fire the maroon as the first bike left the grandstand.
Yes.
And Henry Kissick was at the funeral and brought back the ashes in a beautiful blue willow pattern urn. And on the day of the race, there were some 600-700 people here, and Henry gave his little speech, and he explained what we were doing. And he timed it very well, and about 30 seconds before the maroon went off, he stopped speaking. I had positioned myself outside the shelter, some 30 yards up from the hotel. It was a beautiful morning. The vicar was here, and as the maroon went off, he started to speak. Everybody stood quietly to attention. There wasn't a murmur. All we could hear was, way in the distance, the bikes very, very faint. I walked slowly down, sprinkling the ashes. You could have heard a pin drop. The wind just gently blew the ashes into the gutter, as if to keep them out of the way of the bikes. And as we finished the prayers and the sprinkling of the ashes, we stepped to the side of the road, and the first bike came down over the hill. Very impressive and very emotional indeed.
Nowadays, visiting bikers have a whole range of accommodation to choose from. Everything from hotels to homestay, or book your individual pod in a state-of-the-art pop-up TT village. It was Felix Gale who saw the potential in camping, not just providing a pitch, but the tent as well. And he set about offering this at Glenwillan, as he explains here to David Collister in a conversation recorded 20 years ago.
How did you advertise it then? Did you get help from the tourist department or anything?
No, we just did it all on our own.
Yeah.
We advertised in the camping papers across.
Mm.
And we went to the exhibitions and went into exhibitions and got contacts there.
Yeah.
So, oh no, we were on our own.
Mm. Now, you've got pictures here, on the wall here, of the campsite and what you had.
Yeah.
Now, there seemed to be a lot more than half a dozen tents there.
Yes, well, we had probably half a dozen in the first year.
Mm.
But in the TT week, there'd be about 150 campers bringing their own tents, possibly.
Yes.
Come.
Yes.
So before the TT people came, we decided, we advertised in Manx Radio and the local press about these furnished tents. And local people were coming down and trying them for a weekend, and the word got round.
Mm.
And some of them had been campers in ordinary tents, but a lot of them, it was the first chance they'd had to go camping.
Yeah.
So one or two of them, even at that stage, they bought some tents off me. So I was selling tents, among other things, then. So we got them all set up. And then, because TT week, it was sheer chaos. But we'd been used to chaos in TT week because we'd been running hire cars.
Yes, yes.
So it wasn't a big surprise for us.
So you'd be swamped then, were you?
Oh, completely, absolutely. And they were coming in all through the night and like that. And I think that's where we scored a good point. Whenever they came, first thing we did, said, OK, before you go in, have a cup of coffee. And we had a little chat, and then we showed them where to go. Well, they couldn't understand this, because normally when you go to a campsite, people said, give us your money and off you go.
Yes.
Because they said, we pay now. No, when you got time, settle, come and see us again.
Yeah.
So, and we were looking at TTP, it was so good.
Mm.
Felix Gale talking there about making Glenwillan into a hugely popular camping site. Keeping the surface of the roads in the best possible condition for safe racing has always been an issue. Here, Onkin-born politician Jack Niverson explains to John Moss that he and his colleagues were always open to discovering new methods.
Yes, on the treaty races, of course, there's a great difference today. The surface of the roads is done with this mechanical tar spreader, the Blown Ox. Incidentally, it was the late Mr. R.C.W. Brown and myself and Mr. Cecil McFree, Mr. Willie Brew, we went over to London to see this wonderful machine that was laying down this tar macadam by a machine. Whereas in the past, they put a surface of tar, firstly, and then scatter the chippings on top, and then roll it into some degree. But there wasn't the amount of bitumen that there is today in the mixture, and it was quite common for, on a very warm day, for them to have warnings there was tar on the road at this place and that place and the other place, because the sun had melted this tar. And some of the roads were not made up with the tar macadam, and they were more or less dust roads to a very large degree. And if you saw a fellow coming around the mountain, you'd first thing you'd see was this dust trail. They'd say, ah, oh, here he is, coming around the mountain. I think it was more attractive than what it is today. I think everybody went to the races, the local people. It was a complete close down in the early stages, and the races were the major thing as far as attractions to the island was concerned.
That was politician Jack Niverson. And true enough, the whole island doesn't now come to a standstill, and it's now possible to watch the races anywhere in the world. But I think it would be true to say that the TT Festival still remains an enormous attraction, the most significant event that happens on the island. And we really can't reminisce about the TT without some vintage commentary too, now can we?
1966 was a history-making junior TT, for the trophy went to a continental rider for the very first time in the event's 55-year-old history.
And history was made in more ways than one in 1966, for the race was held on August the 31st, delayed since June the 15th because of the shipping strike. Of the 71 starters, two men in particular stood out, Mike Harewood and Giacomo Agostini. Harewood, winner of 8 TTs and 350 lap record holder at 102.85 on an MV3, but this year riding a Honda 4, on which he'd already become world champion, was hot favourite, especially after his record-shattering victory in Sunday's 250 TT. Mike might well be concerned about Agostini. A champion of Italy since 1963, he was third on an MV3 in the junior TT last year, his first race in the island, and this year had done a practice lap at 101.3, only a second slower than Harewood's fastest. The start's been delayed for 2.5 hours until 4 o'clock, the latest ever junior TT start, due to heavy mist on the mountain. At Crosby, a mere 4 miles from the start, Harewood, number 11, is going like the wind. He's third on the road already. And now Agostini, number 16, with Joe Dunphy's Norton, which is obviously in trouble. Yes, here's the news that Harewood's definitely retired at Bishop's Court with a broken magneto trunk. So all Agostini's got to do is keep going to win. But here's another sensation. Second on corrected time at Balaf, it's the AJS of Peter Williams in his first TT. All the time, the phenomenal Agostini is increasing his lead. Here's Agostini, coming in to win his first TT. Peter Williams finishes an inspired second. And surely he'll be on a works bike next year.
And now we come to the winner of the 1966 Junior Tourist Trophy races at a record race speed of 100.87 miles per hour. He put up the fastest lap on his second lap at 103.09 mph. He was riding an MV from Italy, Giacomo Agostini.
I think it's true to say that most of us long to get into the road's open car. Maybe just being a passenger would be enough. Maybe some of us would love the chance to drive it. But this person in the driving seat has his own particular reason, and we'll find out more as David Collister chats with Brian Milchreist.
I got involved because I wanted to get the cut that my cars, if you like, onto the circuit, you see. Right. I was in the motor business, and this was a bit of publicity, no yeah. question about that.
Yeah.
So I managed to engineer this, and in 1947, I'd only been out of the army about a year, but fortunately, I managed to get the job, you see.
Yeah.
So that's really how it started.
What would you be driving in 1947, can you remember?
Oh, very much so, because I was with the Athol Garage, just come out of the army, and I'd very much taken with the Riley motor car, which was rather a sporty car that was made before the war, and now they were making them again after the war, and I was going to sell these things. And I knew, you see, that the manufacturer was using these Riley cars for rally work on the continent, and it was a sporty saloon car. So that's what happened, and I managed to persuade the Autocycle Union to let me bring one of these cars over for this course work. And, yeah. and once I got my toe in the door, if you like...
That was it, then.
That was it.
Well, let's talk about speeds, then. Was it something you had to do as fast as possible?
Well, let's be frank. I mean, the roads open car is the first thing that anybody sees on the circuit at the end of an event. So this is a course of 38 miles, and it's no good a chap crawling round, you know, opening the roads, because by the time he got to the start, he's been on the go for an hour or so, and that's keeping the public off the road. So theoretically, he follows the last bike. Now, even back to the time I started in 47, bikes were motoring along at 100 miles an hour. They were only averaging 80, 90 in the race. Mm. But, you know, you had to get on with it. And therefore, you had to have a car that was capable of doing 100 miles an hour. I mean, today they're doing 150 miles an hour. But in those days, if you were doing 100, you were going pretty quickly. I mean, you were not doing that all the time, because this is a twisty circuit. But, I mean, there's no question, down past my house or on the mountain, in 1947, you could touch 100 miles an hour. There's nothing clever in that.
What was the fastest you ever touched?
I can't really honestly remember, David. I mean, you know, we were pushing it as fast as the car would go.
Yeah, yeah.
And you had to be careful, because although you're in a nice long straights, there's an awful lot of twisty stuff. And the cars were not as good on the road in 1947 as they are today.
Of course,
you had to take all these things into account.
Yeah, the roads weren't as good either, were they?
Well, they weren't indeed, you're quite right.
Now, did you ever have any incidents when you were opening roads or not?
Well, fortunately, I didn't. I mean, and that's boasting a bit, but I never hit anything or crashed. I had
no animals on the road?
Well, yeah, no, I suppose the most exciting thing, one year I was driving towards Belaugh Bridge in this Riley car, and as I was going along, I suddenly smelt fire, and I looked down at the floor, and there were flames actually coming through by my feet. So this was serious stuff. So I stopped the car rapidly, and I realised that the car was on fire, in effect. So I opened the bonnet and found that the car, what had happened, one of the petrol pipes had broken. And, of course, with the heat, it set fire to the engine. But I don't know how I managed to do it, but I grabbed some sods off the hedge, threw them in on the engine, and the fire went out. And I saved
and
the
you
car.
Carried on?
Well, no, the papers got it that I carried on. I didn't, in fact, because I couldn't, you know, I'd have to get it repaired.
Yeah.
But I did see a chap with a car backed into the road ahead of me. I grabbed the board. I said, "You're opening the road." He said, "What do you mean?" So anyway, we've stuck the board and off he went. but that was probably the most exciting thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying the other drivers didn't have incidents, so there have been occasions, but not much.
No. And you normally would have somebody, perhaps a VIP, alongside you as well, wouldn't you?
Well, indeed, yes. I mean, this was one of the perks. There were a queuing up always for this. And there's no doubt, I mean, over the years, I've had some very interesting people, you know, generals and so on, and I've had Prince Philip himself. When he came to the TT, I think it was 49-50, he on the first time he came, I didn't take him round, but then he came again, I don't know, about 10 years later, I think, can't remember the exact date. And yes, I did take him round on a course inspection, not to open the roads, but the roads were, it was between races, and it was in an MG car, and we put his flag flying on the front, and he put a Tilbury hat on, and we went round, and the crowds loved it.
Yes.
There was an amusing incident before this, because I had a phone call from one of the tabloid presses in the UK. They'd got this story, you see, and they said, we hear you're taking Prince Philip round the TT course, and you've been quoted as saying that you're going to take him round at 100 miles an hour. And you know, the palace are not very happy about this. So I said, well, look, I said, you've quoted me wrong for a start. I said, I may have said I'll touch 100 miles. I wasn't going to lap at 100 miles an hour. That's a different story. But in any car, you could go along Sulby straight at 100 miles an hour. But anyway, that we got through that one all right, and he enjoyed it.
Did you always have a different model of vehicle every year then?
Well, I had a working arrangement with the manufacturers whose cars I sold, you know, let's face it. And I got very friendly with the managing director of the MG car company, John Thornley. And at that time, the MG cars were being raced and rallied all over the world. And of course, they liked the publicity. And they even were developing, when the Mini became a Mini Cooper S, which was a quick car, it was all developed by the MG car company. So I had an introduction straight away. And we got these very interesting and very quick cars. They were all based on production cars. They weren't racing cars, but they were rally cars and that sort of thing. And they were quick. And of course, it was wonderful for business.
And in part two of this programme, we'll hear what Brian Milchreist's son David had to say when he took his father's place in charge of the Rhodes Open car in 1977. And I'm afraid that's where we have to park the bike, take the helmet off, and return to the present day. But I'll be back the week after next. That's Thursday, June the 13th, with the second part of this collection of nostalgia from the shelf marked Tourist Trophy in the Manx Radio Archive Room. That's where I found a song from David Collister, a poem from Doc Tilbury, a chat with veteran competitor Stanley Woods, a visit to the Mayor's Parlour with John Surtees, and the rest of this story.
It's not easy to join, but it's even harder to leave. Once you're in for life. It's not just for Christmas.
So when you all get in your 80s, you'll still be doing it?
Well, I'd hope not. No, some of us are closer to our 80s than others.
You've done private shows at Government House, haven't you?
We have, yeah. By royal appointment. We've done a show for Prince William. We also did a show for Prince Edward and Countess of Wessex as well. The interesting one was when we did the show for Prince William, he actually wanted to come out with us later on down onto the promenade, and we dressed him up in a coat, and we put the helmet and the goggles on him, and he was all set to come down, and then the governor shouted him in because his tea was on the table, so he couldn't come with us. There's no hanging around. There's no kind of like playing about. It's full on race, and we do have a few injuries. In fact, there was one guy last year who was off work for 3 days with a broken flask. You know, it was terrible. And another guy said he was in casualty because his wallet was torn, you know, things like that. But, generally, we just get a few scratches and scrapes. But it is, when we're racing, it's full-on racing, basically.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And I really hope that you can join me then. But if you can't, don't forget that this and all programmes in the Archive Room series are available as podcasts for you to listen whenever it suits you. Simply go to manxradio.com, choose the podcast tab from the homepage, and search for the Archive Room. But for now, this is Judith saying thank you for listening, and I wish you a safe and happy TT Festival and a very good evening.